Hello, and welcome to another episode of GSC's podcast. And now for something completely indifferent, where we'll be discussing the hottest topics and trends in Canadian health benefits. I am the producer and editor, Sarah Murphy. Before we get started with today's episode, we would like to remind our listeners that the views expressed in this podcast are those of the individual speaking and not necessarily the views of GSC. We may talk about possibly controversial subjects and therefore reserve the right to potentially offend some listeners, but are apologizing for it up front. You can download this podcast from our website at greenshield.ca or subscribe to it from wherever you get your podcasts. We also encourage you to read our publications, The Inside Story, Follow the Script, and GSC Talk, which you can also download from our website. And please be sure to follow the conversation on Twitter and LinkedIn. And now let's get started. Today's episode is hosted by David Willows, GSC's EVP of Digital Innovation and Brand Experience. Hello, David.
Hey, Sarah.
How's it going?
Good. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Welcome to 2021.
We're here to talk about a podcast we did last year, though.
Yeah,
We're very transparent about these things that, you know, we record them and then we are hugely strategic about when we release them to the world. Or I like to position that as being strategic,
we think we are.
It's just like we just like have too much stuff and we don't know when we're gonna release things and it has to go in a certain order. So finally we've got to this podcast, yes. An inside story that's been ready since Q4 of last year.
That's right. Correct. Revealed. Yeah. Secrets revealed.
So our inside story is going to come out with this, and it's all about medical cannabis, and it's sort of a look back to 2 or 3 years ago when it was all the rage. It was the hottest topic. And I was fascinated as we got to the end of this year that nothing really happened with it. Like we had podcasts and we had articles and we had product launches and stuff like that. And like literally nothing happened. And I want to have the uncomfortable conversation about why we all thought this was a big thing and the world didn't. And I think we just named this podcast, yep. Don't Believe the Hype. So for anybody listening, that is a Public Enemy reference. That's where my mind was when I wrote Don't Believe the Hype. So that goes in combination with my Black Lives Matter mask that's on our new website. Yes. So I'm in that sort of semi-revolutionary frame of mind these days. So we have to warn folks for this podcast that, you know, we're a few podcasts into sort of the team's podcast world where we're doing this with different technology. We don't have our beloved room inside the GSC offices in Toronto. No, we've got some technical challenges in this one. Specifically, we've got our old friend Mike Sullivan talking here with our colleague Ned Poiskitch, and we had some trouble with Mike's audio. So it's going to be a bit of work for people to listen to this, but Mike always has super smart, thoughtful things to say. So we're encouraging people to forge through it. It's not a long podcast, but both, you know, Mike and Ned have really, I think, good insights and balanced insights on why this thing didn't take off. So we're telling you now, doesn't sound perfect, but hey,
but the content's good.
The content's good. And in a non-perfect world, as we're sitting in even deeper lockdown now, it's like, really, you're not going to complain about this, are you?
No, exactly.
No, right. We have much bigger fish to fry in our society than a little audio trouble on this. So I hope people enjoy it. Good afternoon, Mike and Ned, and welcome back to the pod. It was exactly 3 years ago, the end of 2017, that we first talked about medical cannabis. And I think we sort of thought this was the hottest topic out there at the time. And both of you gave some expert opinions on where we were then in terms of just paying for medical cannabis through healthcare spending accounts. But we knew we were entering a new world where we were looking for plan sponsors to consider embedding it more broadly into their health benefit programs. And both of you had some very specific ideas around how that should be done. The reason we're back here 3 years later is because I wanted to ask the question, what happened? And with a perception of this thing didn't turn out to be the hottest thing ever. I don't know what the ratings were for that podcast, but it probably didn't translate into sort of huge activity in our health benefits world. So I'm just going to go back a bit to that conversation. Very clearly, I remembered sort of the advice coming from both of you was to have a very sort of specific policy and program in place and extending benefits for medical cannabis for those conditions. Can you guys remind me, what were the three conditions we were thinking of then?
Sure. Yeah. And the three conditions haven't really changed since. So it's spasticity in multiple sclerosis. It is nausea and vomiting due to chemotherapy and chronic neuropathic pain. So those were the three conditions that had the most evidence and continued to 3 years later.
Mike, has anybody sort of expanded that list with good evidence, or do you agree that we're sort of still at a place where those have sort of the best evidence behind them and are what should be indicated for plan sponsors to consider?
Ned's right on. I would say that those continue to be the big three. The only addition has been a couple of forms of pediatric treatment-resistant epilepsy. So in the U.S., the FDA approved Epidiolex, was almost 2 years ago, and we don't have the product in Canada, but we are seeing the only approvals that we're overseeing outside of neuropathic pain and spasticity and CNIB, the only ones are around pediatric treatment-resistant epilepsy. That's the only one I would add. And I think we thought, and going back to what Ned and I were talking about 3 years ago, I think we thought that there were going to be potentially a wide list of additional ones like PTSD coming up the list pretty quickly. But the evidence base has been really slow. And I think that's just a function of a lot of things, including the economics of the cannabis industry now, the time it takes to do proper clinical trials and build that into the evidence base. And I think Ned would agree. I think the reason why those three categories that exist today exist is because they are all byproducts of synthetic products that have been manufactured by the pharmaceutical industry, like Nabilone, that have been put on the market. That's why we have some evidence in those areas, but the rest of the space continues to wait. So outside of epilepsy, Dave, not much activity.
Is there sort of a broad consensus as, no, when the evidence comes, there'll be a natural process to add it, or is there any controversy about this?
I'll speak from my perspective in terms of what we see at Cubic reviewing these claims. It's a nightmare. My greatest relief in the last 3 years is the fact that medical cannabis has not become, quote unquote, a thing. The amount of time it takes to properly manage a medical cannabis prior authorization claim is somewhere between 4 to 8 times the time it takes to review a cancer claim. It's an outrageously arduous process. And the reason for that, Dave, is because you're dealing with any physician can authorize this, or in some cases, it can be authorized by a nurse practitioner. There is very little regard for evidence. A lot of the claims that we see coming in are not for evidence-based conditions. They're for conditions that people feel they've been using and treating with for some time. And I want to point out that they might be saying, listen, this has a great impact for me, and I'm not suggesting that it doesn't. But the use of evidence and evidence-based models in individuals authorizing coverage and seeking it, it just doesn't exist. So it's been a huge problem. There's more demand outside of these categories than inside by a wide margin.
Okay. I'll pick up on the same point Mike made, which is the conditions we're paying for are not the ones people are using it for. The ones people are using it for anxiety, PTSD, depression, those will be the wide usage ones. So we do have an imbalance here, right? But also the ones that people are using it for are not the ones that are, you know, that have the strong evidence. And there is a disagreement, I think, in the industry, and we're being sort of asked by licensed producers and others to consider, you know, to approach things, quote unquote, differently, to look at maybe other types of evidence, to consider some of these elements, right? And I think if we're holding true to the rigor and the importance of science, and that's ever more important now in COVID, as we've seen with drug therapies and things like that, we got to stay true to what makes sense. And those conditions are still the leading ones. I think we're And the other point that Mike made is really important, right? So when we talk about the evidence supporting medical cannabis, we're actually talking about the evidence supporting the synthetics, and because that's the bulk of the evidence. So the idea is you could simply go to the synthetics, right? I'm hopeful and encouraged that the evidence will grow. But at the moment, I think we are precisely where we said we are. It hasn't grown dramatically since 2017.
Okay, so that's great. That sort of gets us up to speed on sort of the landscape and how it hasn't changed over the last 3 years. Can I get to the crux of the reason for this podcast? Mike, why do you think that this thing didn't catch on?
The most significant reasons, Dave, number one, is an unknown. You've got a product where somebody might be using 0.5 gram a day. They could be using 4 grams a day. which product are they using? Are they using a product that has an $8 per gram cost, an $80 per gram cost? Are we talking about where's the dosing end and what do we have to have from a coverage standpoint? I think the fact that this was potentially a therapeutic alternative being introduced that had an incredibly limitless potential uptake and very little idea about where the cost piece would be was very concerning to plans just from a sustainability standpoint as they face an ever-rising burden with existing specialty meds. But I think the other most significant issue is that 3 years later, Dave, from this conversation, workplace impairment testing hasn't gone anywhere. So there's no sophistication and there's no ability to be able to manage and measure impairment from THC in the workplace, the same way you can measure impairment with blood alcohol concentrations. Therefore, if you can't measure impairment, you can't manage it and you can't make accommodations for it, which is why any company that has any exposure with safety sensitivity is saying, we can't bring this on board. And I think those have been the two, by far the two biggest reasons why we haven't seen any uptake. And I think the third is the fact that we're not going to see some of these landmark trials and cases that are being appealed with respect to coverage. We've seen a couple of decisions that have come out, like the Skinner case in Atlantic Canada, but there's going to have to be a lot more precedent set in cases heard to understand what's going to be the impact of employers, what kind of accommodation do they have to make in the face of a lack of appropriate workplace testing technology. So I think those, from my perspective, and Ned, I'd be curious if you see it any differently, but those have been two of the primary issues on our side.
Yeah, I completely agree with those, Mike. I think those are definitely have been some of the challenges. I think some of this too is just, you know, to some degree, order of operations, right? So we've had the issue of legalization and how employers are going to accommodate and develop policies, procedures, and all that kind of stuff for the legal recreational use. And then secondary to that, I think they're thinking about it from the perspective of medical benefit. So both have to be considered. And I think to some degree, employers have had to first deal with this other issue before they look at this issue. And I am starting to see sort of glimmers of interest, maybe perhaps this year is coming up probably more often than previously. But I agree. I mean, the adoption has been below 1% in terms of the number of our plan sponsors that have adopted it to date. And I'm certainly not expecting that to grow to double digits or any such number anytime soon. And I think the evidence base too, the carriers have generally been quite consistent in our approaches, not only in terms of the indications we pay for, but also just generally how we feel about medical cannabis as a benefit, right? We're generally consistent in saying that there's limited pockets of evidence and that if we want to start anywhere, let's start with those. But the message has been probably quite the same from all of us.
So I take it from this conversation, neither of you thinks that we're sort of on the precipice here of it's about to hit. There are changes happening where this is going to become more prominent in the next year, two, or three. Am I right to say that we're probably years away from this being a mainstream health benefit?
100%, Dave. From our perspective, there's almost, I would say, the vast, vast majority of claims that we see come in for prior authorization are for individuals who have started using cannabis, medical cannabis, through the recreational market. They've tried it on their own because they know they couldn't get coverage to their plan or it wasn't an eligible benefit, and they wanted to see how it's worked, and then they want to bring it for coverage under the guise of, well, hey, listen, this is an existing therapy for me and it's been working. And I think as we see more and more and more of that, things may start to change moving forward. But, you know, the other problem is the industry itself is profoundly immature. So as soon as the recreational market opened in October of 18, then all of a sudden the medical supply got cannibalized. So in what normal mature industry would that happen? Where there were, and there's still issues with back orders and product availability, and specifically with high CBD products. And so, you know, I think the industry itself has to take some of the blame that it was pretty amateur in how it handled medical versus recreational. And that still creates a problem to this day. The other thing is too, you've got a problem where if somebody has a 20 milligram per mil THC product, it's not the same from one licensed producer to the next. They all can have different equivalency factors in their product, which means that the amount of THC you're actually getting per quote unquote gram of dried cannabis can be profoundly different from one licensed producer to the next. But at least if you're getting Humira or Lipitor from a pharmacy, you know you're getting plus or minus 5 to 10% of the active ingredient in every dose in every pharmacy you're going to with cannabis. It can be a completely different product, even though it says it's got exactly the same thing on it. So we've got issues around standardization. We've got issues around availability. And so I think from that perspective, the market is going to have to get far more mature before we get there. And until we see any kind of impairment testing improvement, I think that will forever be the bedrock for employers that don't want to go down this path to say, I'm not interested, we're not going there.
If you look at it too from the perspective of like, why hasn't it caught on as a benefit? Why it likely won't catch on as a benefit? You still have the stigma element as well, right? So even for, you know, plan members that may not be achieving optimal therapeutic response with prescription drugs and may want to add this on as yet another trial, they're not necessarily knocking on their employer's doors and saying, start covering this. There is certainly that stigma element. And what's interesting about this uniquely, like compared to drugs, is that I can walk to Ontario Cannabis Store. Not walk, it's mail, I guess. So I can get a mail.
Have you measured the walk to your local store? Is that what you're saying?
No, but I guess what I'm saying is I can go get it without a prescription, right? I can get it from a recreational stream and treat my illness, right? And then, you know, I can't do that for drugs. I can't walk to a pharmacy and say, can I have an opioid or can I have, right? I need to go through the medical process. So self sort of treating and some of those things will occur. And I think at the plan sponsor level, unless you're hearing that grassroots movement of this needs to be a benefit, you're probably not responding, right? So there's also that feedback loop that's probably not functioning at the moment.
I would say there's another important element to that Ned's touching on, and that is the other problem is that medical cannabis was being seen as an ability to be able to escape other therapies. If I can start a medical cannabis, I can reduce or eliminate my need for opioids. And who's going to argue against that in an era of an ongoing opioid crisis? If I can get off my anti-epileptic medications and things like that, then there's a profound health benefit because some of those drugs are really ugly and toxic. And so there's an ROI to the plan, because if I'm using less benefit, or if I'm not on disability or STD or LTD, or if I'm using fewer drug benefits, then investing in the cannabis is going to produce an ROI for the plan. But that hasn't been seen. None of that's been seen. And it likely is never going to be seen, because if we think about the drugs, for instance, every major opioid is generic now. The price is irrelevant. I mean, if you look at the cost of an anxiolytic, they're pennies a tablet. And if we look at the cost of analgesic therapy for nerve pain, so if we're looking at some of the SNRIs and we're looking at, you know, any of these other products that people are using, the cost is maybe a dollar or two a day. And when you're looking at medical cannabis, it can be orders of magnitude more than that. So I think the other big problem from a plan sponsor perspective is they're well aware that this is going to be an additive cost. There's not going to be an offset somewhere else in the plan.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, I think we've answered the question, and I think we've probably done a good job of predicting that not much might change in the short or middle term around this issue. But it was something that was sort of gnawing at us inside our team about remembering the hype, the excitement around launching this into the marketplace. And I think it's interesting to go back and look at ourselves, you know, individually and as an industry and say, where were we then and where are we now and what's likely to happen in the future? So you guys have been great in giving us that view. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Good seeing you.
Good seeing you guys as well.
Thank you to our listeners for tuning into another episode of And Now for Something Completely Indifferent, a Canadian health benefits industry podcast. To be sure to get future episodes, please subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or visit our website at greenshield.ca and head over to the blog to download. As a reminder, we talk about these issues consistently in our publications, which are available on our website as well as on social media, so be sure to follow the conversation. For today's episode, be sure to check out our most recent issue of The Inside Story. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk again soon.